Luke 15, verses 11 through 32. Then he said, "There was once a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father, 'Father, I want right now what's coming to me.' So the father divided the property between them. It wasn't long before the younger son packed his bags and left for a distant country. There, undisciplined and dissipated, he wasted everything he had. After he had gone through all his money, there was a bad famine all through that country, and he began to hurt. He signed on with a citizen there who assigned him to his fields to slop the pigs. He was so hungry, he would have eaten the corn cobs in the pig slop, but no one would give him any. That brought him to his senses. He said, 'All those farmhands working for my father sit down to three meals a day, and here I am starving to death. I'm going back to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I do not deserve to be called your son. Take me on as a hired hand.' He got right up and went home to his father. When he was still a long way off, his father saw him. His heart pounding, he ran out, embraced him, and kissed him. The son started his speech, 'Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son ever again.' But the father wasn't listening. He was calling to the servants, 'Quick, bring a clean set of clothes and dress him. Put the family ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Then get a grain-fed heifer and roast it. We're going to feast. We're going to have a wonderful time. My son is here, given up for dead and now alive, given up for lost and now found.' And they began to have a wonderful time. All this time, his older son was out in the field. When the day's work was done and he came in, as he approached the house, he heard the music and dancing. Calling over to one of the houseboys, he asked what was going on. He told him, 'Your brother came home. Your father has ordered a feast, barbecued beef, because he has him home safe and sound.' The older brother stalked off in an angry sulk and refused to join in. His father came out and tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't listen. The son said, 'Look how many years I've stayed here serving you, never giving you one moment of grief. But have you ever thrown a party for me and my friends? Then this son of yours, who has thrown away your money on whores, shows up and you go all out with a feast.' His father said, 'Son, you don't understand. You're with me all the time, and everything that is mine is yours. But this is a wonderful time, and we had to celebrate. This brother of yours was dead, and he's alive. He was lost, and he's found.'"
Well, has the road back home ever seemed like a really long road to you? It can be. When I put a big crease in the side of my dad's 1958 Pontiac and had to drive home, it was a long ways home. Maybe it was a long way for you when you had to tell your parents that your girlfriend was pregnant. Maybe it actually was a long drive. Maybe you were driving home after dropping out of college. You knew your parents weren't going to be very happy. Maybe it was a very short way home, but it seemed long because it was just the walk from the fields to the barn to tell Dad, "I've made up my mind. I'm not going to take over the farm. I'm getting out of here." It could be a very long road home. Of course, it makes a big difference as who's waiting for you when you get there. As you get home, are you going to be facing a harsh, maybe even violent parent who says, "I'm going to whip that one out of you"? Or are you going to be facing a loving parent who, even though they are hurt and you know what you've done has hurt them, still love you, still care about you? Well, it's that latter that I represent to you today. In one of Jesus' best known and best loved stories, the parable of the loving father. That's really the best word, the best name for it. The parable of the loving father. The road home from the far country was indeed a very long road. The fact is, it's never easy to have to eat crow. It's never easy to have to say, I have sinned against heaven and against you. It's never easy to say to somebody else, you were right and I was wrong. After all these years, it's still hard for me to have to say that to Jan, because even though it should be getting pretty easy how many times I've had to say it, but it still is a hard thing to do. You were right, I was wrong. But for this young man, he really had sinned against heaven and against his father. He demanded his share of the inheritance while Dad was still alive, and that was unheard of. Dad was the one who was running the farm, but the younger son comes up to him and says, hey, I want my share. I don't want just a little bit of it. I'm getting one-third of the entire inheritance. That means you need to go and sell off a third of the acreage of the farm, because that's where the wealth really was. Sell off a third of the acreage. That's mine. Give me the money that you get from it. And you know what that meant. That meant that Dad and the other brother are left at a big disadvantage. They don't have all of the resources they had before to farm with and to work with. It was basically wishing, saying to Dad, I wish you were dead now, but if you're not, at least give me what I got. And then he takes off. And he goes not just to the next town, but he goes off to a far country. He breaks all ties. He says, I'm never going to see you again. There's no cell phones in this story. There is no email that he can keep contact with. He's out of there forever. And while he's there, he then acts like sometimes we do, irresponsibly. He wastes the money that he has. There were all kinds of lottery tickets available in that country, and he bought on every possible one, except that he never got to be the winner. He kept on coming up empty on all of those. And there were plenty of people wanting to sell him investments. There's this really great deal, you know, and if you put your money into it, I can guarantee you it's a penny stock now, but it's gonna take way off, and put $1,000 into it. And he did. And they tanked. But then, of course, there was also just the party scene. There was always a party to go to, and there was always somebody who was willing to say, hey, yeah, you buy me the drinks tonight. There was all kinds of ways. And it finally was gone. It disappeared. How quickly? And then to boot, you end up with a famine in the land. And you know what a famine can do in an agricultural economy. And all of a sudden, everything kind of falls apart, and the whole economy tanks as well. And the price of essentials, when there's famine, even food, basic foods, prices go up. And he doesn't have any money in the first place. And if there's a famine, there's no food growing. There's no place to go along the road and pick up stuff and glean a little off the trees or glean a little out of the fields. It's not there. The world is falling apart for him. And with all of the things going wrong in the world, who's going to hire a loser like this guy? He finally can only find one place to get employment. He finds a farmer who says, yeah, I need somebody to go out, take care of the pigs, bring the slop to them. And here he is, a Jew. Pigs were unclean. They were at the bottom of the list. You would never have any contact, but that was the only thing he could do. But they wouldn't even give him pig food. That was for the pigs. He didn't even get any of that. Well, it gave him plenty of time to think. You've got to admit that. Maybe you've been at that spot in your life, a place where everything is going wrong, and at least you've got some time to think. Your world has fallen apart. And it says in some beautiful words, he was coming to his senses. His mind was starting to work right instead. And he weighs the options. And he thinks, well, there's risk in going back home. What kind of reception am I going to get? But there sure are an awful lot of risks in staying where I am and doing what I'm doing now. And finally he says, I might as well go home. Even if I'm only a servant, at least the servants in my dad's house, they get some 3 square meals a day. And I'm sure not eating anything now. You know, it's amazing, isn't it, what trouble can do in your life. It's amazing what happens when the addict finally gets to the bottom and hits that spot where they realize this is just not working. And they start to come to their senses. It's amazing what happens when your business goes broke and you find out and you realize it's not just somebody else's fault. It's just that you don't have the management skills. You're not called to be a business owner. And you've got to do something else, and you finally come to your senses. Or you get to a point where your marriage is falling apart, and you realize when you're honest, it's not all her fault. Part of it is yours. It's not all his fault. It's mine. And you start to come to your senses. But boy, it can be a long road home. But this guy finally says, I've got to do it. And so, we know, he finally gets to that point and he says, he gets up and he goes back to his father. Maybe you need to do that. Maybe that's where you are right about now, that you're on that road way the wrong way. Maybe you're not even very far down that road yet. But maybe you're not living in the far country yet, but you're thinking about when you get there. You're thinking about the time is going to come when you get out of home, get out of Binghamton, get away from your parents, get off to college, get off to your first job, and then you're going to live it up because I'm going to finally be free. And I'm going to do the wild living thing. I know it'll have some cost, but I'm going to do it anyway. Well, let me just give you an urging right now. Don't go down that road. Get off that road right now. Turn around even when your thoughts, even before, and get back home. But maybe you're here today because you've been on that road and you're in desperation because life isn't going where you thought it would. You had your plan all laid out and you thought everything was going to be great and you were going to do your thing and you were going to do it well and you find out it isn't happening. And you are coming to your senses. And let me just say, get on the long road toward home. Turn around. Keep walking. And don't put it off. There's a long road home from that far country. But there's another road in the story, and it's a much shorter road, but it's also a very long road. It's the road home from the field. Because there's a second person in this story. It's the older brother, who's always been, as the story tells us, always been right there, been close by. Mark Twain had a pretty good description of this older brother. He said, he was a good man in the worst sense of the word. Think about that. A good man in the worst sense of the word. I think that's pretty accurate. You know, he wasn't there every day pushing his dad and saying, okay, you gave the third of the inheritance to my brother. I want my two-thirds now. The oldest son got the extra portion, you know. But he wasn't pushing for his dad for that right now. He was the good son, remember? But in the meantime, every time he'd go out into the field, he would be steaming about all those acres they had to sell off because that brat of the younger brother had gone off and wanted it all. And look, if we had all of our original farm, we could be doing so much better and we could be making so much more. It's all his fault, and it's still steaming about that. And every day when he'd go out to the field and he would do his chores, he would be grumbling in his mind about the extra work he had to do because we used to do it together, but now it all falls on me. And I've never had a vacation when you're the main one. I mean, Dad's old, and I'm the one that has to do all the work. And if my brother is here, he's out partying, and I've never even had a chance to do a vacation because the cows need milking every day, and there's no breaks, and they need to be fed, and I'm just stuck here. And he's not one to disobey his dad, but you could just hear the wheels turning. Dad is so old, and he's so old-fashioned in the way he wants to run this farm, and he's the boss, and we got to do it his ways because it's his farm. But boy, let me tell you, there's a lot better ways, if only I could do it. But he never says it, of course. And now he comes home at the end of a hard day, and he walks up to the house, and he hears about a party. And he finds out that the sound of the party is there for his brother, and he is furious. And of course he doesn't say it, but you can just hear it in his mind as he finds out what's going on. And he says to himself, I will be damned if I go into that house. Well, he wouldn't say it because you don't say those things, you know. But he refuses to walk that last 30 yards and go into the party. Maybe that feels familiar to you. Jesus told this story, you know, for the Pharisees. In the beginning of chapter 15, talks about how the tax collectors and the sinners were gathering around to hear Jesus, and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were muttering, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. We've got a better way. We're the good ones. We've done it all. Where's the party for us?" Well, maybe you've been in the shoes of this older brother. Maybe that's the shoes you're in now. Doing all the right stuff, being good for all the worst reasons. It's getting to be tax time, and you're going to pay your taxes, but you're going to grumble all the way about it. And you're going to not have an affair, even though you would be tempted to do that, because you know it's your wife is going to take you to the cleaners if you do. And besides, it's not worth the hassle. And you come to church, not because you really want to, but because it's a whole lot easier than fighting your parents every day, or than explaining why you stopped coming. Maybe that's the road you're on. But that's a long road, too. And I urge you to realize, if that's the road that you are on, that that really isn't the way it ought to be, that there is a better way. You, too, need to get on the short road toward home, because you will be damned if you don't. If you stay out of the party, this is serious stuff. But remember, there's a third part, a third person in the story. And that's the parent. The parent who is there to welcome. The loving parent for both of the boys in the story. The loving parent who's there for us, the one offering life and party and not damnation. That's what the younger brother found. Did you hear that in the story? The welcome that he got when he got home. If the younger boy's earlier actions were outrageous in demanding his inheritance, you know, the actions of the father were pretty outrageous in the story too. Here's this father, respected, an elderly gentleman doing well in society. But he always is out there on the road, looking down the road. People were looking at him and saying, "What's the matter with him?" But he's not wallowing in pity, saying, "Oh, how could he have done that to me?" He's not out there in coldness saying, "Well, that's the way it is. I don't even want to think about him anymore." But he's still out there with a heart of compassion. Did you catch that? He sees, he looks down the road, and lo and behold, even before he sees the tattered clothing that's on this boy and the shoes that are falling off from his feet. Can we get the picture up here? I wanted to show that once again. Rembrandt's picture of the prodigal. And this is when he comes back home. But you notice the clothes are pretty worn out. Notice the shoes? The one is hanging on by a strap. The other one's got holes in the bottom of it. Rembrandt caught the idea. Let's just leave it up there for the rest of the time. But, you know, even before he sees those details, he knows it's his son. And he sees and can see the dejected, broken posture of this slow walk down the street, fear-filled, wondering what is going to happen when I get home. And the first thing that it's described is the heart of that father is compassion. He cares. And in fact, he cares so much that he does something which was totally out of character, totally out of keeping with a person of his status in society. He starts running down the road. And that was not expected in his day. But he takes the initiative. He's the one who runs to meet the son. He's running, why? Maybe to protect the boy. He knows that if he comes into the village and some of the other villagers nearby see him coming, they're going to really lay into him, because everybody knows what had happened when you make a public sale of property to give money to a little young kid who wants to do his own thing. He comes and runs to protect him. It says that he hugs him. You see that in that picture. He's kissing him. He has that heart for him. He cuts him off in his request. He starts talking. You know, he has his rehearsed speech, the son does, and he doesn't even get through it. He never gets to the part of, let me be your servant. And he says, hey, we got a party. And he's getting all the details taken care of. He doesn't have time to listen to the boy anymore because there's things to do. Come on, get the robe. Not just any old clothes. His are pretty beat. But give the best one, the one I would wear when I go to the city to sit in the city gate and when everybody can look at me and respect me. Put that one on him. And give him the ring, not just a little old cheapy, but the family signet ring. The one that he could use to say, I have authority again to make decisions about the property and about the farm. I'm back in good graces. And he's got not only the ring, but he's got shoes. He says, and get him shoes. And that's more than just he's got some old ones. Slaves didn't wear shoes. This is the sign of being part of the family. The Negro spiritual from back in the slavery days in this country, one of the beautiful freedom songs, that really was a freedom song that they would sing, is about, I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children's got shoes. And it wasn't just to keep their feet warm. It was a sign they were free. They weren't slaves anymore. And then there's the fattened calf. This is not just some leftover soup from the back kitchen. This is a party that we're going to invite the whole town. You don't kill a fattened calf for two people. You kill it for the whole town. That's the way it is. In God's house, when the lost are found. Do you notice, if you go back to Luke chapter 15, there's three different stories that Jesus tells. The first one about the lost sheep. And how does it end? There will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over the 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. There's a lost coin. And again, rejoice with me. I found my lost coin. And when this son comes home, we've got to party. There's parties. That's the welcome that waits you if you're on that long road on the way back home. But you know, there could be the same welcome if you're in that short walk just from outside the door a little ways. Maybe again, we're more like the older brother. Maybe you just have that skepticism when you hear stories about conversions. You hear people talk and give a testimony about how their life was all miserable. They were in jail. They were on drugs. They were doing all those horrible things. And then they met Jesus and their life has changed. And you say, yeah, okay, they will. Just kind of skeptical. Oh, give me 50 years and we'll see if they're still there. Kind of the older brother part. Maybe you're a little bit jealous when the church makes a big deal about a new believer. And look, I have taught Sunday school for 20 years and nobody has ever said much about that. Or I've been on council on and off as an elder and as a deacon for all these years. And nobody's ever said thank you to me about that. And then they get this new person and they make a big deal when they become a member. He's angry, says it right in the story. But notice what the father does. The father says, I want to welcome you. And he takes the same kind of steps, really, as he does with the younger brother. Because again, the father is taking the initiative and he goes out. He leaves the party for a while, goes out to his son and says, you've got to come in. Come on. This is the right thing. I want you in the party too. Jesus remembers telling this story to say to the Pharisees, there's a better way. Get beyond your moralism. Get beyond your legalism that says we're doing it all right. We're being good, even if it's all for the worst reasons. There's grace. God is gracious. He goes out to this older son. And this story here too is filled with just as much invitation. Come on in. You've got to join the party. And so the big question is for each one of us who are here today is where are you? On what road? Are you still running away? Are you still on the way out to the far country? Turn around. Come back home. Are you still in the wild living stage? You're here just because you had to be. Well, come on home. Maybe you're coming to your senses. Maybe that's where you are now. Well, don't just think about it. Come on back home. Maybe you're on the road. Keep coming. Go all the way. But maybe you're out in the field and you're going through all the motions of being obedient and being the good person, but you're angry, arguing with God about this whole business of grace. It isn't fair. I do so much for the Lord and nobody pays attention. Maybe that's where you are. Well, come on home. Come to the party. And maybe you're enjoying the party. That's what I hope you are. Because if you're anywhere but in the party, take a look. Look who's inviting you. Their loving parent of a God who's not only waiting, but who's running out to meet you, who's coming and putting his arm around you and saying, come on in. Don't stay out here. Because the place to be is in the party. That's where we need to be. There's a wonderful party. Come on and join it. Let's pray.
Scripture reading this morning is found in the book of Mark, and there's three different passages that are listed in your bulletin and can be found in the Pew Bible, or you can simply just listen along. Jesus predicts his death. He then began to teach them, the disciples, that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and children of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, get behind me, Satan, he said. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. And then over in chapter 9, verses 30 to 32, he predicts his death again. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. Then turning to chapter 10, verses 32 to 34, Jesus again predicts his death. They were on their way up to Jerusalem, with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. We are going up to Jerusalem, he said, and the Son of Man will be betrayed, and the chief priests and teachers of the law, they will condemn him to the death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. This is the word of the Lord.
You've probably seen it, the mother duck leading a string of furry little ducklings across a field or across a road on the way to a pond. That mother duckling is up in front, that mother duck is in front and is very purposefully, boldly leading the way across the street, across the grass, heading to that pond. After all, she knows that ducks are made for water. It has been one of her favorite places, and for a while now, while she was sitting on those eggs and as those little ducklings were first being cared for, she didn't get much chance to get to the water, but she's on her way to where she wants to be. The ducklings, on the other hand, aren't quite so sure. They're following. They've learned to trust their mother. But as they get to the water, they hesitate. This is something new to them. They really don't know what it's going to be like, and she goes and walks right on in and Some of them are a little hesitant, and maybe they need a little nudge to get pushed off the bank into the water, where once they get in there and start to swim around, you can see them just having a great time. They are where they wanted to be or where they were meant to be, swimming happily. Now, I know that's kind of a hokey picture, maybe, but it's a little bit like the picture that we see in the Gospels of Jesus and his disciples. You see Jesus out front, purposefully, boldly, heading to Jerusalem. He is on his way. He knows where he's going. The 12 and some of the other followers are going along, but they don't have that same boldness. They don't have that same confidence. Jesus is focused. They are confused. And they're walking along that road with a mix of negative emotions, wondering what is all going on. And we today look back on that picture that Mark shows us three different times, and we look back on that picture from 2,000 years perspective. And I'm hoping this morning that we will be able to look back on that with a deep joy in our hearts, not with the confusion of the disciples. Three times Jesus tells his disciples they're on a road, as we have been on a road with Jesus for these last several weeks. And they're on a road that is very focused, a road to Jerusalem, a road to the cross. And I trust that this will be a transition for us as we get ourselves ready this week to enter into the season that we call Lent. We'll have a service Wednesday evening for those who can make it of Ash Wednesday. And we invite you to be here at 7 o'clock to participate, if you choose to, in the putting of ashes on, but at least to prepare our hearts for this special time as we, too, walk with Jesus to the cross. As we see these passages in the Gospel, we see, first of all, a leader who is very focused on the way in which he's going. From the very first time Jesus spells it out to his disciples, Jesus makes it very clear that he knows exactly what his life plan is and what these next months are going to lead to. Now, it may seem a little surprising that in Mark chapter 8 that Jesus starts talking about his death, because in the context, the last couple of chapters in the Gospel of Mark, things have been going actually very well for Jesus in his ministry. You would almost expect him to say, wow, let's just stop and smell the roses. Let's just enjoy all these good things that are happening. There have been big crowds that are gone wherever Jesus goes. In chapter 6 or 7, we talk about how one time he fed 5,000, probably more than that. It was 5,000 of the men, to say nothing about all the others that were there as well. And it wasn't just one time. At the beginning of chapter 8, he talks another time. There's a crowd that's 4,000 or more that are gathered together. He's been healing people. It isn't just Jews. He goes away. He gets up into Tyre, and the area in chapter 7 talks about he goes to the vicinity of Tyre, which is up in modern Lebanon. It was not a Jewish territory. But even there, and he goes there, a Greek woman born in Syrian Phoenicia comes and says, I know you're a miracle worker. You can cure my daughter. Cast a demon out of her. People are hearing all over the world, it seems, in the area, about who this is. Oh, yes, there are some troubling signs. In fact, Jesus, just before we started reading here, has said something about watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. The political and the religious leaders are not very happy about what they see with all these big crowds of people gathered around Jesus. And yet it would be very easy just to overlook all of that for right now. And then there's that wonderful confession of faith that Peter makes. And so just before this section where Tim was reading this morning, Jesus and his disciples are still out of the mainstream of Palestine, out of the main Jewish areas. They're way up north in Lebanon again, in the area around Caesarea Philippi. And the question comes, so who do people say that I am? And there's a variety of answers, of course. But then there Peter comes with this incredibly powerful answer. Mark says, Peter's answer, you are the Messiah, Matthew gives us a little bit more detail to it. He says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Wow. It sounds like Peter has got it. He's understood who Jesus really is. And then along with it comes this wonderful promise that Jesus gives to Peter, and it's a promise for us today. He says, I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell itself, the gates of death and Hades, will not be able to overcome it. And I tell you, I'm hanging on to that promise. I think it's a fantastic thing that's still going on today. Jesus is still building his church, in spite of all the opposition and whatnot. And then Jesus, in the midst of all of that, right after that, it seems, says, and then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected and must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. It's going to happen, you see. God's going to build his church, but it's going to happen not in a human way, not with Peter figuring out how he could do it so good and how he could be the best church leader that there was ever going to be. But Jesus is going to build his church in his own way, and the way is going to be a strange one. It's going to be the way of the cross. In fact, he says in this first time around, he emphasizes it's going to be the religious leaders, the ones you think that would be part of the building of the kingdom of God. They're the ones. He says, I must suffer and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, the whole religious establishment. Goes on, the next time he talks about it in chapter 9, gives us a little bit of a more of a perspective on what's going to happen. And he says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered over to human hands. He's going to be killed, and after 3 days will rise. But there's going to be a betrayal. It's going to be people, surprising people, are going to be the ones that are going to be the instruments of this death. And then as he goes the third time, he adds even more detail to it. He says, the death that I'm going to be facing when I get to Jerusalem is not going to be quick and easy. It's not going to be a bullet through the head. It's going to be a painful, a difficult one. And they're going to condemn, the leaders are going to condemn him to death, and they'll hand him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And when he mentions the Gentiles, you're getting a picture. This is not going to be just this is going to be something that's going to be a cross, because only the Gentiles, only the Romans were authorized to kill by crucifixion. He's already hinting at that. Each one of these words of warning and saying what's going to happen ends with the promise of the resurrection. But that wasn't heard. It seems as if the disciples never did catch that, or at least understand it, even though it was to be a very vital part of the plan. But Jesus then is on the way to Jerusalem with a very clear plan in mind. He knows what's going to happen, and you can say that when he got to Jerusalem, there were no surprises. It's not like he got there and thought it was going to go one way and it went a different way. And yet, knowing about the plan, he still goes. He's focused. In fact, he says, there's no options. It's a necessary path. Did you catch that in Mark, in the first reading, in Mark chapter 8? He says, a must, that little word. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected. There's no plan B in God's plan or in Jesus' purpose. I know it's kind of a little bit forced, but sometimes at Christmas time, and we're studying and thinking about the birth of Jesus Christ, some artists have come up with a depiction of Jesus in the manger. And you see in the barn there, and you see the baby laying there, and Joseph and Mary, and some animals around, and maybe a few shepherds around, and so on. And then you see the light that's coming somehow through the window of the barn, and through the cross pieces of the glass, even though there wasn't glass probably in those days. But anyway, in those cross pieces, you get a shadow, and or you see a shadow of the cross on the wall beside the manger, behind it. And you know, even though it's a little bit forced artistically, it's true. Jesus came for one purpose, and that was to go to the cross. And there have been hints of this along the way in Jesus' ministry. When Simeon gave a blessing to the baby Jesus, he said to Mary, "You're going to be pierced through. You're going to suffer too." Well, pretty abstract, pretty vague. But a little bit later, we read another thing. We find out that John the Baptist calls Jesus the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. A sacrifice. That's what a lamb was supposed to be, right? And then in John chapter 3, we get another picture, another hint. Jesus says, "As the Son of Man is going to be lifted up, just like Moses lifted up that snake in the wilderness." Another picture, the same idea. Now, there's a lot of critics of Christianity who don't like the idea of the blood. Say, "Oh, Christianity is such a gory religion." And now you can criticize Mel Gibson for the excessive blood and gore of the Passion of the Christ. And I think he may have gone a little too far. But the fact is that Jesus came to die on the cross. I must go to Jerusalem to die. Now, I like John 3, verse 16, that God so loved the world that he gave his Son so that anyone who believes wouldn't perish but have everlasting life. Fantastic verse. Great. I love the idea and of preaching on the idea of the challenge that comes then to us as followers of Jesus to live in love, to love one another, as well as to love God with our whole being. True, but I can't avoid the cross. Jesus knew that this is why he came. He came to die in our place. Yes, God is merciful. I thank God for that. Without the mercy of God, we'd be all in impossible situations. But God is also just. And that means that God cannot, he will not just overlook sin and say, "Oh, well, that's a little problem. I'll just pretend it didn't happen." For justice says what is wrong needs to be dealt with. It cannot just be overlooked. And so from the beginning of the Bible, already in Genesis chapter 3, we're told that sin, disobedience, is going to have consequences. If you don't obey, you will die. Romans 6 tells us that the wages of sin is death. I can't pay the price. You can't pay the price. No human being can pay the price. There can only be one who is truly God who can pay the price for my sins. And so Jesus must, not might, Jesus must go to the cross. That's focus. And did you notice that Jesus goes voluntarily? It's not then that he says, "I must go. I don't really want to." There's another little snippet when you get to Mark chapter 10, as the picture is the last of the three. They're on their way up to Jerusalem, and Jesus is leading the way, and the disciples are following along behind. Jesus is leading the way. He is no victim. There's no forcing Jesus to get to Jerusalem. Yes, he's human. Remember the cry that comes when he gets to the Garden of Gethsemane. He is not enjoying what is going to happen to him. He becomes deeply distressed and troubled when he gets to Gethsemane. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. And then you get a little bit farther, his prayer. "I know, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." He's human. He knows this is going to be an extremely difficult and painful time. And yet, he voluntarily goes. He's not planning another way. There's not going to be any sword play. Simon Peter didn't catch that part. He tried it. Jesus stops him in a big hurry. There's not going to be an attempt to evade the cross, to find a way to hide from the troops when they come. He doesn't go to the Gethsemane because he thinks it's a hiding place. This is love. Love that motivates Jesus. And there's a big difference between doing something because you have to and doing something because you want to. We're all starting to think again about paying our taxes. I hate to bring up bad news, but it's part of the reality, all right? And as we look at our paying our taxes and we figure out how much we have had to pay in this year or whether we might get something back or whether we're going to have to pay something more, we know that part of what we pay is going to fund some of the welfare programs that help other people in their times of need. And for sometimes we look at that and say, well, I don't have any option. I guess I have to pay that part of it too, just like I have to pay all the rest of it. That's quite different than when you meet somebody along the way and you find out that this person is homeless and you offer voluntarily, I will pay your first month's rent. There's a big difference between the doing it because you want to and doing it because you have to. Jesus goes to Jerusalem and he leads the way. He's voluntarily on the way. A road that's going to lead to a cross, but that also leads to Easter. And it's a road that he's going to stay on to the end. And so we see this picture, first of all, of Jesus, who's very clearly in the lead, clearly focused. But we also see these disciples who are walking along like the mixed up, confused, scared ducklings along the way. There's quite a range of responses in these three different places, but all of them show confusion. The first one is typical Peter. Typically brash. And if you read the way it's described here in Mark's Gospel or in Matthew's, Matthew again adds a little bit more of the details yet beyond what Mark does, but you get the same picture. Jesus says, I must be killed and on the third day rise to life, and Peter takes him aside. And the word there literally is, Peter grabbed him. I mean, he didn't just say, hey, let's talk about this quietly a minute. He grabs him by the arm, says to him, and starts to not question him, not talk with him a little bit about, are you sure about this? He begins to rebuke him. Both Gospels tell the same thing. Peter, typical Peter, I'm going to do something first. I'll start talking and then I'll think later on. And he says to Jesus, this will never happen to you. You are wrong. I won't allow it. You may think that's what's going to happen, but listen, I'll take care of you. Typical Peter. And what does Jesus say? You just don't get it. You didn't hear what I said. The audacity of it all. He still is dealing with the typical Jewish idea of that day, of a Messiah who's going to come in riding on a white horse with a big army behind him, get rid of the Romans. He missed out on the part in synagogue school and Sabbath school about the suffering servant. Peter missed that part, apparently. And Jesus quickly shuts Peter up. He says to him, get behind me, Satan. You don't have in mind the concerns of God, just human concerns. Whoa. Get behind me, Satan. The person who just very, very shortly before he has said, boy, you are Peter and on this rock I'm going to build my church. You got it. You know that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. And now he says, you're Satan. Well, I think he says that because he hears in Peter's words echoes of what he had heard a couple years before. When Satan takes Jesus off into the wilderness before he's ready to start his ministry and comes with all kinds of temptations, and each of the temptations is, there's a different way. There's another way. You don't have to go to the cross. Come on, get the crowd on your side. Turn stones into bread. People will follow you. Anybody, they'll do anything for free food. Nope. Well, show them your power. Climb up to the top of the temple, jump off, and just before you get to the ground, whoosh, whoosh, swoop on up, and you won't even hit your foot. Just think what people will say. They will really be impressed. They'll follow you. Nope. Well, How about this? You don't have to tell anybody. Just right here. Bow down to me. I'll give you it all. You don't have to go to the cross. No. And now Peter says, no, we won't let you. You're not going to the cross. It's just another form of the temptation. Get behind me, Satan. I must do this. And we don't hear Peter saying anything more. Although later on, when he gets to the garden, he's still swinging the sword. But Jesus repeats this prediction a little later, and this time nobody says anything. Nobody wants to be called Satan, I guess. You know, they probably, the rest of the disciples and Peter remembered, I'm not going to say anything this time. And so in Mark chapter 9, we read that they did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. They learned, keep your mouth shut. But they still don't understand it. They're confused, especially that part about rising again. But let's not even talk about it. Maybe it's a little like, you know, sometimes you go to a doctor and you've got a little problem somewhere and the doctor comes back and says, well, there's a spot. There's something that's a little, we're not sure what it is. How often don't we just say, well, let's get out of here. I don't want to know more. I don't want to ask. I don't want to find out. Maybe that's what the disciples were like. Matthew tells us that they felt grief. They were grieving when Jesus said this. Well, that's understandable too. If you didn't catch the part about the resurrection, you know, Paul talks about people who grieve without hope. Well, if there is no resurrection, there is no hope. And yeah, if Jesus is going to die and that's going to be the end of the story, you can understand why they would grieve. And through it all, it's fear. Fear of the unknown. Fear of shattered dreams. Fear of loneliness. It's all so confusing. And yet they're still following along like those little ducklings kind of wandering on their way. There's something about Jesus being so focused, his determination, that impels them to follow, even if it seems like it's going to be hopeless, maybe even fatal. There's an interesting picture in John chapter 11. It's the story of the death of Lazarus. You know, and Jesus gets the word that Lazarus has been really sick, and then he doesn't go right away. And then the word comes, and he says, let me tell you plainly, Lazarus is dead. And the disciples say, well, okay. And then Thomas says to the rest of the disciples, well, let's go. He's going to visit Mary and Martha. Let us go. It's getting awful close to Jerusalem. It's a lot of dangerous territory, but let's go that we may die with him. He's been talking about dying. I suppose we might as well go. Not a whole lot of confidence in that. And so we have these confused followers. But I don't want us to end there. Because remember the last part of the picture, the ducklings in the pond, enjoying the pond, enjoying the river. And the fact is, that we look to that road and see Jesus walking to Jerusalem from the perspective of 2,000 years later, after Jerusalem, after Easter, because we as Christians are above all else, we are Easter people. And don't ever forget it. That's the heart of the good news. Today, every Sunday, is appropriately understood by a lot of liturgical Christians as a little Easter, every first day of the week. We're going to start Lent this week. And Lent is a period of time, but according to the traditions and the way of calculating the days of Lent, the Sundays during Lent are not considered part of Lent itself. They are in Lent, the first Sunday in Lent, not of Lent. Because they are still Easters. We cannot get away that while we anticipate the cross, it's in that perspective of the empty tomb. So next Sunday we come and what we're going to do is celebrate the Lord's Supper. And it's a time of remembrance, but more. It's a remembrance of Good Friday, about the cross, of the broken bread and the cup of juice. But it's also a remembrance of Easter. Because when we come to that table next Sunday, Remember that Jesus is the one who is the host. He's not the victim. He's not on the cross. He's not on the table as somebody who's dead, but he's there inviting us to his table to be nourished for walking and living with the living Christ. And so we view the cross today as Christians. We view the cross through the bright light of the empty tomb, through the promise that Jesus not only overcame his own death, but that he overcomes ours. So that when we face our own death, we face it not as an end, not as the final destination, but as a transition of life that goes from this life to another. And so I ask you this week, take some time to prepare to come to communion. Take some time to examine yourself. Be honest about your own grief, your confusion, your fears. Be honest about the fact that many times we walk like the disciples, but also face them honestly, and then make sure that as you walk in a life that is not always easy, that you view this life through the lens of the cross and the empty tomb. That these are deliberate, voluntary acts that Jesus did for you. And when you then come prepared with that thought, seeing it all through the lens of the cross and the empty tomb, then next Sunday when we come together again, we can certainly come with joy to meet the living Christ. Let's pray.